And I better take these headphones off because the cord's too short. Yes. So, I'm Jim Meadows, and it's July 23rd, and I'm here in Flanagan, Illinois, with Delbert Augsburger. It's Delbert J. Augsburger.
Right.
And you're a native of around here. You grew up in a farm in Flanagan.
Right. Just 2.5 miles outside of Flanagan.
Okay. Big family?
Yes, sir. Quite a bit of. I think very well. There was 10 of us, and six boys and 4 girls.
Where were you in line in the family?
Right in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I had four older than, I don't know how many that would make younger. But
so as far as you and your brothers, were you the middle brother as well?
Yeah, I got 2 brothers older, and I've had 2 brothers younger, Joe and Clayton, Donald. Three brothers younger.
Mm-hmm. And Mennonite family, so you
Mennonite,
all grown up.
We brought up Mennonite, rural Mennonite church, mm-hmm. Old Mennonite church.
Now Mennonite's historically what they call a peace church, as I understand.
Right. Well, that was they didn't believe in that time. We never, the farther the the beliefs go, we didn't pay that too much attention to them then. We just went to church and did this. Mm-hmm. And my parents never, my dad never really, he was kind of a soft-spoken man, and he never made any demands on us. We kind of went our own way, but we did, of course, have to go to church every Sunday and all this. But when we come to the decision of going into service, well, my dad was under quite a stress. My mother had died when I was a senior in high school. This was only 2 years. The war was already just starting when my mother died, and he was left with the family, and we still had 4 or 5 of us at home yet, 6 of us home, I think there's only 2 left. And so that put quite a burden on him, and he had a lot of problems at that time. And we kind of went our own way. He didn't have time to really make any decisions for us. We had to make them all ourselves. Mm-hmm. But he didn't finish high school, you know. And then I'm not working at that time, too, there wasn't that much work to do on the farm, so I did start working for a plumber in Flanagan. And so I worked at the plumber for a year, and then when I was going, before I went into service, I already had the job at the hardware store, which we did plumbing and heating. Mm-hmm. So actually, when it had my on a resume, that I was a farmhand, but I was actually already working in the hardware store, the hardware business, in heating. And well, not air conditioning. I didn't do air conditioning until I got out of the service and went to school on my GEI bill. But so I actually wasn't. My profession was never really farming. I just grew up on the farm, basically.
But you were listed as a farmhand. You got a farm deferment for?
Yes. At that time, agriculture was one of the important jobs, anyhow, that you would be deferred if you was needed as a job. I don't know what they would call a preferred job or essential job. Mm-hmm. And farming was an essential job at that time. So if you had, but the small farm that we were on, it would only be big enough for one deferment. So when we were, because it was only 18 months between my other brother that went in. And so actually, when it was my time to go in, and then I got deferment for a year or two, almost 2 years that I got, otherwise I would have been in the service before that, see. But I got a farm deferment. And then I got a younger brother going up, so then he took over the deferment. Then when went for my physical, I didn't have a deferment anymore, and that's why I was, mm-hmm. Conscripted now, to go in.
Now, did all of your brothers go in as well?
Just the 3 of us was at the, during the war.
Okay, there's 3 of you total. There's
that went in at the one time, yeah.
Okay, so the whole family, I'm going to make sure I have the math. It's a family of 5, well, 4
six,
brothers.
And, actually, 6 boys altogether. My older brother, Merlin, went in as a conscientious objector.
Merlin?
Augsburger. Merlin was my older brother. He was the first one who went in. He was drafted as a CO. He went in.
And what did he do then?
He was in constructive service. I think he was in a forest service for a while. And then we got a letter from him. He said, I can't do this anymore. I can't live on my good looks or something like that. He was going to join the service. So he while he was in the CO camp, he signed up and joined the, at that time they called it cavalry, which, of course, he was kind of a horseman in that, but they didn't really use horses anymore. But that was the name. I think they used horses for parades and stuff like that. But then, of course, it just was right down to just more or less an infantry unit that he went into. And then he got sent over. He settled over in the Philippines for a while, and he went through several campaigns over there.
So,
and then my other brother, Dean, before he was in, maybe a year before I was, not quite, and he's 18 months older than I. And then he went through Patton's Army all through Europe and that, and in the armored division. And then I had the younger brother. Of course, the war was long down then, but he was in service for a certain length of time. Then the other younger brother, but they were still being drafted yet for several more years, Brother Joe.
So all four?
All except one of them. He had bad eyes. Mm-hmm. His sight wasn't that good. He didn't get in. But,
okay.
All the rest of us. But we was only, it was only the, well, the four was in on one time.
Okay. But in total, there were?
There was five.
Five yeah. of your brothers, or the five of you,
yeah,
were, all went in except for the sixth brother with poor eyesight, had the
bad eyes.
One of them was a conscientious objector first.
Yeah,
then
he changed over to the regular army.
You were drafted. Was everybody in your family who went in drafted?
Oh, yeah. We wouldn't ever think about enlisting at that time. That would have been... Not that we didn't want to, but that, you know, if you, of course, we had the conscientious objection seen behind us, you know, thinking about it. So we just never went against the church and have it. But we was drafted, it wasn't quite a choice, you know.
Well, was that something that all of you were talking about or thinking about at the time?
I had quite some friends that went in CO, you know, and conscientious objector, but I made a little I had a little decision for a while, but I had enough Bible studies that I remember one thing that Jesus was asked this question. He was given a coin and a denarii, I think they called it then, and somebody asked him about paying homage to Caesar, and he looked at the coin, and it must have been, the coin must be something like the coin we have now, like we have in God We Trust on the one side and the picture of the present. And he showed the picture, and he said, well, look at the one side. He said, he turned to one side, and he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and the things of God, the things that are God, and turn the other side of the coin. So I thought that right there was a commandment, you know, that you... Whatever the government asked you to do, that was a thing you should do.
Was that a difficult point of view to have in the community?
Not too much. No, but like I said, my dad never pressured us. We had our own choice. And it was the reason why, of course, I did it probably, one reason why I always wanted to fly. And as a kid on the farm, I always had the idea of, you know, someday I'd want to fly, and of course, get the opportunity. And even at home, we didn't have many toys or not, but we made it look like an airplane out of a plank and some wheels and put it on the log with two sticks on it and pull it behind the buggy down the field like he was taking off flying. That was one thing. And then Charles Lindbergh was one of my... heroes. when I was growing up, and I always admired him, you know, and that was the thing. And I thought maybe I would get in and get some pilot training. Yeah. And as it turned out, I did get my pilot's license through the Army, but not directly. After I got discharged, I had some schooling. I had four years of school coming, and so I took a year and a half out of getting my private pilot license. And then I went to other school. I went to heating air conditioning school down in St. Louis.
Now, at the same time, as you know, during that same time, I guess, when you were just turning about 20 when you went in?
Yeah. It
was in the middle of the war. Everybody was talking and thinking and worrying about the war.
Right.
So everybody must have had points of view about what to do.
I'm not just too sure why the big decision was. To me, it wasn't too much of a decision. I know some of the older people were already in CO, but see, a lot of them, it was also, we had the option of going non-combatant and get into the medics. And that was kind of my idea when I went in, to get into the medics. But when it came up, going down the line, had a chance to take the Air Force test, I took it.
Okay. And now, you had said before, was it an older brother or a younger brother who did become a CO?
An older brother, the first one that went in.
Okay, so he sounded like he was the one who was most affected by that.
Yeah, I think the older one was. And not only was he had more of the mindset of that, because he was working for one of our devout church members at the time, that we thought he was one of the deacons of the church, and he was working for him as a farmhand at that time when he went in, and that might have affected his decision a little bit too, going in as a CO.
Yeah, was it tougher for someone being a CO? I mean, in the midst of
They were looking. You call them yellow bellies, things like that. You know, they got the name as a total run as a community.
That would happen in Flanagan?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've heard them.
Even with the Mennonite church?
Right, being prominent. I would think we had three Mennonite churches outside of town, but of course we had the two Lutheran churches here and the Catholic church in town. The Mennonite church was prominent south in the churches out in that area.
Okay. But it's still something that they had to put up with.
Yeah.
Was that, you said he had changed his mind, was that part of the reason when he decided to?
Well, I'm not too sure. Like you say, his conviction probably wasn't that strong either, you know. He was, like I said, where he worked for, the man he worked for was probably one of the strong reasons. Because I know my dad never said, you should do this or should do that. He let us have our own choice. In fact, it was never brought up.
He never seemed to have any strong opinion either way as
no,
to far
he,
as what your
he
decision.
Must not have, because I don't remember him ever saying anything against, you know, not going.
Did you ever hear from your church about it?
Yes, after I got out of the service, there was talk in this church about letting us come back into church, you know, how they was going to make it right for us to get back into the congregation. Well, at that time, I really didn't care too much about the congregation, because I was going with my wife, Betty Jo, and we was, and she was a Methodist. Of course, Methodist was quite a bit against conscription too, but not as strong as the Mennonites were. But it was no brainer for me. But I think it was just before we got married, the minister come around and have a paper to sign to make it right with the congregation so you could get back into full membership. Well, that didn't make me a difference. In that time, I'm not in a position to argue. It didn't make any difference. Well, I said, you know, at the time, I said, well, I'll agree that I did go against the teaching of the church, but not because I thought it was wrong, you know, of the teaching though. So I signed it. My wife never liked it too good that I did sign that. But I never went back to the church after that. I joined the Methodist Church.
So you've been a Methodist since then?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm still, you know, I still think a lot of the church. We still do a lot with the church out there. And, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of cousins belong to the church out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went, you know, once you signed up, where did they take you to first?
First thing I went to Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, basic training. And that's another thing that when I first went into the service, you know, we didn't think too much about just going into the service. It was a big step, but the first thing when I went through the first door, the big sign on the door said, kill or be killed. You know, and that kind of gives you a jolt right there. And so that got you thinking a little bit on what's we getting into here. Because, you know, you never think about killing or anything like that. But that this was the mindset that, you know, that you had to have, kind of, that when you go into the service, that's what they wanted you to be, you know. It was serious business. That's the only time we realized how serious what you was getting into. Mm-hmm. And then, so this is why we say now, we have a little trouble, not too much, but we say we have different, well, I'm pretty strong in the Legion. We do a lot of talking, and there's so many of the people that went in the service didn't get into combat, you know. And they feel a little bit, well, they don't want to say anything. They don't think they did their part. But us that was in combat, we say, don't make a bit of difference if he's in combat or what you saw. You spent your time when you was under control. You was under control of the government. You had nothing to say. You did what they told you to do. And combat or non-combat didn't make any difference. I mean, the person that didn't see combat has as much right as what the person that saw combat. And I think that's the mindset of most veterans, that they don't, you know, we all the same. We don't treat one any different than the other. We just happen to have luck. And like I say, you did what they told you to do. You had no save your own anymore. Nowadays, they do get to sign up maybe what they want to take. Some of them want to take something's computers and things like that. I don't know if kids do that. And they might not get to do exactly what they want to do, and they're unhappy about it.
Well, going over to gunnery school, how much of that was your decision as compared to the...
I had no decision. All right, when I went down to... that's another thing. It was a little bit of disappointment. When I first got into basic training, then we started doing a lot of testing. Yeah. And then, besides our just manual arms and stuff, Air Force didn't have a real strong basic training, like manual arms. We didn't know what, we did a lot of marching and that. But then we'd go on a lot of testing. And then they put up on the board to be accepted into the cadet corps, you know. And then you go up every day, we'd go up and look on the board, our names was up there, what happened to it. And then when my name came up, and it says, there's a different category, passed and non-committed, they had it. Anyhow, they made me feel like I passed all the tests and everything, but right then it said non-committed, which meant they didn't need any more pilots at that time, but we need more gunners. So after they say non-committed, that means I didn't know what they do until the sergeant called us to formation. Lift a bunch of names off, you're going to the gunnery school. And he said, well, I wish I was going with you. Yeah, he was. And so, but that was the only first time that I really know that I wasn't going to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. But it was no big disappointment because I was going to gunnery school. That was okay.
You still get to fly even if you aren't flying the plane? Is that how you thought of it?
Well, yeah. I don't know. It's just an excitement. You know, if I'm you, you know, you like to do something, experience. Yeah, think so.
What was the training like for the gunnery school?
They started you off pretty fast training. The first time we went up, we had a B-17 there, and the first once we had training on, they did a lot on the movies and videos of of what we're supposed to do and that. But the first time we went up on the plane, in the first plane ride I had, we had the open windows on the side of the plane, and we had a tow target up there to shoot at. I don't know why that poor guy was pulling that tow target. But then it was pretty bad, a little bit scary. I mean, a lot of them got sick, you know, the pretty bouncy plane, and you're sitting there and shooting that 50 caliber machine gun out of that target. Because we had all the training before, the sights. You know, at that time we had the rad sights, you know, how much to lead the plane when they're coming into attack, you know, stuff like that. And then we had guys get sick with the oxygen mask. We was up at altitude, we had to have oxygen. We had some poor guys that got thrown up when they have an oxygen mask. I remember seeing them laying there in the belly of the plane there, sick with trying to keep the oxygen mask on.
And now, you never had that trouble?
No, I never. I always got kind of woozy, but I never did get sick. Okay. I never had an appetite. When we get back from a mission flying, I never had an appetite. Of course, when we got back from the mission, they always give us a shot of scotch, you know, they make you feel peppy up a little bit.
Now, the planes you were training in, what type were they?
B-17s.
And you showed me a picture which had the gunner in sort of like a little bubble.
Well, that was a ball turret. When we went through a training, when we first went through a gunnery school, they didn't tell you where you're going to be in the plane. In fact, you practice above ground. You had your turret, just a turret up there where you shot at a moving target on the track. And then I didn't know until we went to Las Vegas and formed our crew that I was going to be a ball turret gunner. And I was kind of my size, I think, because I was thinking the shortest guy on the crew. They had the crew all formed before I met. I didn't know any of the other people. None of them went through gunnery training, but we met these, got together in Las Vegas, and then we start training as a crew, and that was my job then.
So what's it like being, you're sort of like in the bottom of the plane?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the ground is there below you?
Well, yeah. Well, it's movable, and there's mostly plexiglass, yeah. You know, but you can see right down, your controls are up here. You can go up and down and around any place you want.
It gives the gun a lot of flexibility.
The gun's moved with your turret, actually. Mm-hmm. And then they had I think Sperry Ball designed this sight that it looks like a lot of the video cameras we have now, that when you look through there, you've seen the hairs, the little arms in there, and you can control them arms about where you had to frame the attacking plane. And if you could get that plane tracked between these two grids you had in there, and as a plane coming in, if you could follow that, and then of course you had your triggers on each one, and they could tell whether you had that plane or whether you was on target enough to hit that plane. In fact, in gunnery we had that when we start having live planes attacking us. We had P-47s, and whether you even had some B-25s, two-engine plane attacking us because they're pretty short a plane. Anyhow, when we get down on the ground and then they were taking a picture, they had film of that, and they see how you did, how many hits you had just by the camera.
Mm-hmm. So you trained on targets on the ground.
And then we went up, flew.
And then you went up and shot to the ground from there, and you had to shoot at other planes?
Yeah, the planes coming in, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, we had these guys coming in, but it would just be a camera. I mean, we wouldn't be shooting them, but of course. But we had these pilots coming in and attacking us as if they were the enemy plane, and then they could tell how we could frame that plane coming in attacking us, how we were on the target or not.
Now, yes, from what I've heard about being in the position you were, it's like that's like perhaps one of the most vulnerable parts.
Well,
of the plane. Is that true?
I think the most, probably the scariest part was I didn't have room for a parachute down there.
The rest of the crew had
chutes. Yeah, see, they had the parachute. Of course, the pilots, they sat on their chute, and the other ones, the tail gunner, he had his chute already snapped on. The waist gunner, they had the chute that you snap on, you know. And so my chute was hanging up there in the plane. And if we were, something would happen that I, that was, the ball wouldn't move, then I wouldn't get, there was no way I could bail out without putting the gun straight down for that little door you had to crawl out. Mm-hmm. If the guns were straight down, then you could go all through that door. But so you had to, I tried a couple of times to have that chute down there with me, but it was no room, no room down there anyhow, but I tried that. But then it was only one time where I really, you know, had to snap the chute on an emergency that the pilot called me out because when we had the engine shot out, a couple of engines, and we were losing altitude, we didn't know if he was going to go down or not. So I did get time to get out of the ball and put the chute on.
Now, is that something you worried about?
As I was flying, yes, I thought about that quite a bit of the time. How am I going to get out of there? Because I could open the wheel of the hatch and fall out, but then I wouldn't have to shoot. So it was a little bit worried on that because this electrical system went out, but then you wouldn't be able to put that door up into the plane. That was a must.
How much of a, was it a thrill for you at the time? Because you said you'd always wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And there you were, you know, yeah. Even in training, you were really doing it.
Yeah, it was, it was kind of, I mean, I enjoyed the flight as long as it wasn't in combat, because it was a couple of missions that we flew that I didn't have to get down the ball, and you just loafed around the plane, look out the window and get up the nose and watch and stuff like that. It was quite a thrill.
It's a great view from up there.
Yeah.
Now, how long were you in training?
I don't know. I got it in the book, but it was, I would look it up until I went through school. It wasn't that long, because I went in, and then we were flying that summer. So 6 weeks of basic, and then flying was probably another couple months. And so it was probably, I got the first mission then was in the fall.
So that's the fall
of 44.
Fall of 44.
44, yeah. And I'm not too sure what the dates are. But.
When you came out of training, did you feel ready?
Yeah, I thought we had enough training. Yeah, it was pretty thorough. You had to pass so much, you know. If you had in the tow target, you had different color. Your bullets were marked with a different paint, and they could count in there how many hits you had into the tow target, and also the one that I told you, the video that you taking a picture when them planes would be attacking. Dumping planes, they could tell you. Now we had a little bit on the rifle. We got not much as they are, because I think they put the expert on there on one. I'm not too sure what rifle it was, but we had a firing range too that we had to do.
Was the standard high to the point that some of the people who went in with you didn't make the grade?
Yeah, but we never knew why. You know, first in training, you know. We never got acquainted too much with the people of training, because we weren't, we weren't together that much. You group different groups, and your training might be different times, and we never got to be buddies with anybody until we formed our crew. Mm-hmm. And first thing you know, the person wasn't there with you anymore, but you really never knew why.
Okay, so you went from Las Vegas.
Over to Europe then. And another thing that happened, which was luck for me, I'd rather flew over, but we went to Kearney, Nebraska to pick up planes as a ferry the new planes over, because as they were needed. But it just happened that we didn't get a plane. There wasn't any available, I guess, so our crew was sent by boat. Well, then we took a big train ride to Langley Field, Virginia. We was there for a week or so before we finally got on a boat, then they went overseas. So we were a couple months behind the other bunch that I trained with. to get into combat, which was lucky. Because, in fact, on the way over there, the first stop we had in the first night I was in England, one of the stopovers before we went out to the base, one of the kids I was in gunnery school with was coming back already, and he had already been shot down. He sprained his ankle or something when he parachuted out. Anyhow, so if it just by making that much difference of the time it took to go over in the boat was really a blessing for me, to not because it got, as the war went on, we kept having more fighter protection, and it got less German fighters, but the flak kept getting heavier as they kept pulling the guns back, and as they pulled them back, there was more concentrated, like Berlin and Munich, and some of them were really, there was really a lot of
When you say fighter protection,
yeah,
that's protection for you?
Right, we have fighter protection because, see, when I got there, the D-Day was after that, and fighters could only follow us across the channel, then they'd have to go back to the base, they couldn't go that far, but as soon as we start getting some bases, as our army went up through Italy and it got some bases in France, and then we had fighter bases there, and then they would pick us up after we got across, and they could follow us all the way to the target.
That's fighters on the ground?
Yeah.
Okay, so they would be supporting you from the trucks and tanks or on the foot? Or
no, they were just air bases, were that, the fighter air bases, the P-51s.
The planes.
The planes were P-51s. Yeah, they had airfields over there just for fighters. And then the fighter planes weren't on the same field with the bombers were.
Okay.
And then the fighter planes, like I said, they pick us up as though they could follow us and on the target. So that's why we never had that much interference with the Germans.
You were stationed at Basingbourne, you said?
Basingbourne, England.
Basingbourne.
Yeah, it was about 40 miles from London.
Okay. So you would fly missions from there?
Yes. Yeah, we never did land, and we hoped we never had landed. We thought we did a couple of times, but we always made it back.
So in that case, it was once you got to Basingbourne that you formed a stable crew with another
group. We formed the crew in Las Vegas.
Las Vegas?
We did practice missions in Las Vegas. they would go up, and the bombardiers, we have the crew, and they have a circle out there in the desert, and they would have to drop these powder bombs. And which I was in the position on the ball where I could mark the bomb bays, and I could follow the bombs down and see what they did and take a picture of it. They had pictures on the camera, and then they'd show us after we got up, we'd have a meeting in different rooms, and they'd show you what you're... So we had quite a few missions out there, like practice missions as a crew.
And that's the crew that went out to England?
Yeah, then we took off to England. We all went to England together.
Now that's a different thing than from all the other when you were in training. These are people that you really got to know, I take it.
Yeah, after the crew, but yeah, the people in training I never got to know. I never was that group.
Now these were the B-17s.
Yeah.
How many people in a crew?
One time there was 10, and then we got down to 9 because we didn't need a bombardier on every plane. And we didn't need a navigator on every plane. So then what they call him, a toggler, that was the nose gunner then. He wasn't a bombardier, but he would drop off of the lead. Each squadron had a lead plane, and that would have the bombardier in, and then he would drop a smoke bomb, and whenever the other planes went over that same spot, then the toggler would toggle the bombs. So that kept less, we only had to have, we always had 9, I thought. But we ran a little trouble not having a navigator there, too, when trying to find our way back after we lost our group, we didn't keep up with our group. We had some engine shot. We had 2 engines shot out that mission. It's rolled up in the book of that on that one mission. And we didn't know our way back. I remember asking the radio operator what our heading was. He didn't know. And the P-51 seen us out there by ourselves. Of course, we lost altitude. We were pretty low. And, he come up the side of us, and I still got that memory in my mind of that, because I got out of the ball, because we just had to get out of the ball. We thought we had to bail out any time. And the P-51s come up behind us, beside of us.
The P-51 is the...
The fighter plane.
The support.
Yeah, you know, the support group. And, of course, he knew he was in trouble. We only had two engines. Wasn't running. And he knew he was going the wrong direction. We was heading out for Russia, I guess we were. That was way down Pilsen, Czechoslovakia. Anyhow, he come up behind us, and I remember, of course, I was, like I say, I got out of the ball, put my chute on, to go ready to be out, but watching what's going on. And the P-51 come up behind him. He had a hard time flying that slow to keep up with, to fly that slow, but he was doing motions in the cockpit and motion to our pilot, and he was trying to give him, a heading back, and our pilot thought it was a heading back, and he was trying to give it a radio frequency, because he got to talk to that pilot later on, find out what the trouble was. But finally, he just made a big circle around from our tail and buzzed off and had us direction till he got us straightened out, and then we made it right direction. Once they got back over France, and that they pick up landmarks and find the way back to our base, and so we did make it back to the base.
You put on a chute that time.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to put on a chute any other time?
Only one other time in training I did. But other than that, I never put the chute.
You never had to bail out?
No, but we had a lot of people that had, well, the lucky ones that bailed out. If the plane wasn't hit too bad, they could bail out, because they had thousands of prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was so common to get to bail out and be captured as POW was before we flew the first mission. And that's why I didn't know nothing special to get the rank. They made you a buck sergeant before you flew the first mission, because the Germans respected military, and you wanted to be caught by the army and not civilians. If you were shot down, the first thing they'd tell you to do was turn yourself in to the military if you could, because they would respect the army and put you in the prisoner camp, because the civilian caught, they had lots of them, a lot of the farmers and that were killed. I mean, lynched the flyers if they was out there. They killed them with pitchforks or anything. So this was what, so then the latter part of the war, they furnished each one of us with a 45 caliber of sidearm. And the sidearm wasn't for the German army, it was for civilians, to protect yourself against civilians.
Your unit, I mean, your crew never had to face that. You were always able
to. No, we always made it back, yeah.
Why do you, but you said it did happen to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, we, on the statistics now, how many were shot down? Well, I think the, if I remember right, there was 12,000 B-17s manufactured during the war. They kept bringing new ones over all the time. There's 12,000 of them. 4,000 of them were shot down or engine trouble on the mission. So 4,000, see, so that was one out of 12,000, so that would be one out of four. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, that's how many were shot down. And so you remember, and if you figured that the early ones had 10 people in there, how many crew members that would be? Mm-hmm. I think it, something like 50,000 were actually killed. Then the prisoner of war was a real great number, too.
When you think about the fact that it didn't happen to you and your crew,
yeah.
Was it just a matter that the odds were in your favor, or were there things that you could do to evade being shot
down? No, we couldn't do nothing. As a crew members, the pilots couldn't do too much evasive action when they was in formation either. They did do on the fighter attacks. They did do a little, but you couldn't move because, you know, you only had so much room to move because the planes were that packed, that tight together. So I always thought, you know, I never was worried too much about it. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen, because there's nothing I could do about it. Only thing I did when the flak got real heavy, I think if I'd spin the ball, it would deflect the the flak, you know, I did hear some pings around because you could hear. The plane made so much noise, but I didn't feel the concussions of the exploding bombs around you more than what you'd hear them, because the plane was so noisy. You hear a little rumble, but that's all. When you knew they were getting close, the bomb could. And aircraft shells could go off. Well, it's just like fireworks. It just now it reminds you of fireworks when you see how far the sparks fly out around. Like that was something like the anti-aircraft shells were exploding, and they say, well, there's lethal within 30 to 40 feet by one of them exploding. Shrapnel would fly out that far from one of them to be lethal. That would make holes in your plane, or could knock your plane down. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of winced, and nothing you could do. But in fact, the first mission I went on, about every mission we had an aircraft fire, we could tell when we go over the German lines or the line of the fighting men, you know, how far our troops were taking ground, because we would get a little anti-aircraft fire. A couple shots would come up then, but then the first time when you're looking ahead, you could see ahead, and you knew you could see this all the, because when these bombs would explode in the air, they'd always leave a mark of powder. You know, you could see where there's one. Sometimes it would look black. You know you're going to have to fly directly through that. And the first time I seen that, it did give me a chill through, other than that, I just never thought it was my time. I was ready to go. You know, I made peace with myself, and that was, I never was real scared.
Mm-hmm. That was, it must have been different for everybody.
We had a little problem in the plane one time. Mm-hmm. And he was a new replacement, because our pilot made. Lead pilot, we had our co-pilot took over, and then we had another pilot that flew, and he gives a pilot trouble. He evidently what was happening. See, I was down there in the ball. I didn't. Oh, what the only thing I would know is what I'd hear over the intercom, what was happening, and I heard him one time when we was getting hit, real going through bad. The pilot told the engineer to get this guy out of here. I heard later that he had kind of went to pieces, mm-hmm. But that never, you know, that happened after that. We were lucky. Like I said, I was lucky to get over there that late, because when the first ones went over there, they just basically flew until they were shot down. They didn't have much of a chance. But when I got over there, then they put it down 25 missions. Then you got to go home, so you give something to look forward to.
So did you fly just 25 missions?
I only got 23, but the war was, voila. my crew did, but I had ear problems. Did I tell you that before? But anyhow, when I couldn't hear, you know, the flight surgeon had me miss a couple missions, and they went to the flight surgeon. It was pretty crude at that time. Well, you know, when you can't hear, you fly in an airplane enough, and when you hold your nose and blow a little bit, well, they put a rubber hose, air hose, and hold you, put in your mouth and hold your nose, trying to pop them back out. But that's about all they could do to get you. But it was just a couple of missions where, you know, if you have a cold or anything, your sinus plugs up and you can't.
So you did 23, and you were out because of the ear problems, and then by then?
By then the war was over.
War was over. War was over.
European, yeah. And then we got to come, our crew got to come back. Some of our crews went on the Pacific if you didn't have enough missions in, but our crew had enough time and missions in that we got to come back to the States and just set aside, just wait the time out there until the war was over before we were discharged. Mm-hmm.
And during all this time, were you writing home or writing to your brother?
Yeah, my wife, Betty Jo, she was right. She'd write. I get a letter every day from her.
She was back in Flanagan, right?
Yeah, she finished up high school and then when I was in there. And so she kept track of that, and she kept track of some of the letters, and and because it was pretty well published than what the 8th Air Force was doing. Mm-hmm. And she cut out a lot of the things in the paper. And so we looked it up when I got home, and I got some newspaper clippings of telling about the raid that I happened to be on. Uh-huh. So she's the one that kept up. Otherwise, I wouldn't have kept a diary or nothing like that, and she's the one that kept up. And then she made the scrapbook, and then had a niece put it in the scrapbook for him, and so that's why I got the record.
So it was like the raids that you were on, that was pretty much being followed back in the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, event by event.
Yeah, there was. And at that time, even the 8th Air Force would send out little clips about back to your hometown newspaper and really tell you a little bit what's happening. It tells you so many missions. Sergeant Oxberger, or that was on, have be on a mission on that raid. We weren't allowed to write home anything about the missions or anything.
You couldn't be. Could you say anything about what you were doing?
No. We went. I'd ride home and I said, "Well, you can read about in the paper." That's about all I could say.
So what'd you write about?
Probably tell our love there. Yeah. No, we really couldn't tell. I never wrote. She always wrote pretty good letters, but I didn't write that many myself back. But of course, whenever it was, and then even when we'd move out, the Army or the Air Force would send you what you, if you was being sent to someplace else to another address or something, they'd send home that information.
Now, you know, the raids you went out on, was that mostly during the day or at night? What's the best?
I had the best in there. It was all early morning. that was one of the things. Well, that was one of the things. You'd get up when it was dark, the CO would come around and wake you up if he had the list of the people that fly. We flew 3 days and sat down and got 1 day off. One squadron would sit down every day. Anyhow, he'd come out in the morning. It was during about 5 o'clock in the morning, dark yet. He'd come and wake everybody up and shake you if you don't get out of bed and make sure that you got up. And he'd tell you what briefing time was. We had to go to pre-briefing. And we'd go to the mess hall first, and then after that we would go to the briefing room. You know, you've probably seen in the paper where there's a big map, show you where he was going to go that day. Where the fighters might be, or where you're going to get flak, and all this stuff. and then we would get out to the, take the truck to take it out to the staging area. It was just a big old farm field outside the air base where they had the planes scattered all over. See, they didn't put them all in planes so somebody couldn't come up and shoot them up. They'd, you know, disperse them all over the field. Trucks would take us out there, and then when we start revving up there and get ready, they have to take ETO time, and then it would take probably till we could take off and form. It'd have to be daylight, of course, when you take off, and then it would take a while before all these planes flying up there could form and get in their formation before we take off across the channel, and there'll be hundreds of planes flying around in circles up there. It was okay if it was visually, but they'd have one lead plane out there where the other ones are supposed to catch up with, you know, to form. The pilots had all that. But we got up a couple of times, and it was a foggy, and it got pretty scary because the guys, you'd see them, planes would whoosh by you this way and that way. How close it'd come to you trying to get in formation before we would take off across the channel, because we'd always be formed in a formation before we started across the channel. And that took quite a while to do that. Then we got our altitude, and we would get the altitude while we were forming our groups.
Now, the targets, were you going to Germany, or were you...
Most of it was France.
France and Germany.
France and Germany. First, there was some in France. Later on, a lot of them along the Rhine River.
How long was it to take to fly from England to Germany?
I'm not just too sure. I do know I do know the missions were all, the shortest mission was over 6 hours.
That's six longest, hours there and back?
Yeah. The longest one was 9 hours. Mm-hmm. The time we'd take off, and say, I was in a, but I wouldn't have to get in the ball until we started across the channel. Mm-hmm. So I was just being a bit in the waist for our crawl down in the ball and go, start across the channel. So I'd be down a lot of times, 7-8 hours.
You were always shooting at ground targets, or were you sometimes
no,
shooting?
No, we weren't any strafing. We had a little strafing in practice, but the fighter planes done the strafing, and the fighter bombers did the strafing, helped the ground crew. we didn't do any technical bombing, like right ahead of the troops, except, like I say, the Battle of the Bulge, though we went in, we did some bombing there. But other than that, it was all strategic bombing factories and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. And so your job in that case, tell me about exactly what your...
Our job was just to deliver the bombs.
Mm-hmm. And for you there in the gun turret?
Was just protect us from fighter planes.
How often did they come by?
After I was there, we only seen them a couple of times because we had enough fighter protection that they kept them away from us. Uh-huh. So that was a blessing. That's why by being getting over there that late, these first guys, they didn't have protection. You know, they were fighting these fighter planes all the way in the target and all the way back. Of course, they wouldn't be when they go over the target. The fighter planes wouldn't follow them over the target because they wouldn't go through that flak. But as soon as you come back out on the way home back across France or going to, that's when they would attack.
Okay. And so were there some times when fighter planes came on the attack and you had to?
I never fired at a plane, but a couple times I was ready to. And well, in fact, I was there late enough in the war that I seen the first jet that Sherman set up. He come up into our formation and nobody knew what it was. until we read later on that they had these fighters, but he never fired. Well, we didn't have a chance to fire at him anyhow. No, as far as being in danger, it wasn't from the fighter planes. It was an aircraft. Mm-hmm.
And
which kept getting worse as we pulled the guns back.
Was that something that you could fire at?
No.
Okay. So you were just hanging there.
Right there. We just belonged to the ride most of the time.
The incident you mentioned where the engines failed, was that because of the air?
Of the anti-aircraft, yeah.
Okay, so they were shooting at you.
Right. And like I say, they kept getting worse as Berlin was really, they really had the guns there, you know, and we lost quite a few planes from anti-aircraft. In fact, the mission, we call about collateral damage. It bothered me a little bit at the time, and in fact, it bothered the briefing officers that morning, because this was towards the end of the war, and the people, civilians were trying to get out of Berlin, and our mission was bomb the marshaling yards, the trains going out, and they actually told us there would be a lot of casualties, civilian casualties, because of bombing that railroad yard. And all the civilians, mm-hmm. and I don't know how many thousands was killed on that. So that had to be a concern, but nothing you do, you know. It's just like they are today. How many civilians, you know? How, of course, people around here know about it and get all worked up about it. But this is something that happens in war.
Mm-hmm. You just saw it as being unavoidable.
Right. It's a collateral damage, I guess you call it.
You were, now, how often, like how many missions would you go on a week?
I went on 23 altogether. We would go, well, like I say, we'd go three and then sit down one. We'd go, we wouldn't do over probably three, four maybe a week. Mm-hmm.
So not much downtime.
Well, no, we got to go into London quite often.
Okay.
For a weekend, And, you know, there wouldn't be weekends, it would be time that we got pretty well acquainted in London.
What was that like, going, you know, being an American soldier in London?
It was pretty good. We went to the CO club, I mean, no, not the CO, that's the officer club, but we had the other clubs and the dances and everything like that. And in fact, I had a girlfriend over there I met the second time. And this was kind of an interesting thing, too, because it was the latter part of the war, and remember the Japanese already had taken into Manchuria and was already going into the China and that. And well, I met a lady that, well, she was pretty young yet, but she was married, but she was living over in Malaysia, and she was married to an Englishman. And she was pretty well-to-do. They had a rubber plantation. So over there in Malaysia, well, when the Japanese come through, they just had enough time to get the women and children out on boats. They sent them over and brought them back to London. Or her husband stayed over there, but she never heard again from him. You know, they didn't have it. When the Japanese, they didn't have any civilians, or who, if there's an Englishman, they just killed him. So I got acquainted with her, you know, and then when I'd go back, well, then I'd see her, and we'd go out and go through the parks in London and things like that.
Now, had you already met Betty Jo?
Oh, yeah, she, you know. In fact, I showed her Betty Jo's picture. She's
So there was that understanding as far.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, she was Betty Jo dated a little bit too, I think, when I was going. So it wasn't nothing.
Yeah.
We didn't get engaged after I got back.
I guess that was always a question for some people, I guess, who were.
Oh, yeah.
Who might have been engaged or were close to getting engaged? They thought.
Yeah.
I think. Do we have to change tape?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now would be a good time.